It's fun to be with you. As you well know, those of us that are on radio don't always have a chance to see some of the faces of the people that listen to us, but that's also in return. I've had a few of you come up and say, okay, I didn't expect you to look like this. You're taller than I thought you'd be. You're younger than I thought you'd be. I love the fact that you have a voice for radio. Now that I see you also have a face for radio. I don't know what to do with that comment, but nevertheless, I'm getting all sorts of comments, and it is nice to kind of connect with you, and I hope this is not the only time. Matter of fact, we've talked about another trip that I might take through here in the future. Matter of fact, I might just come in here, Robbie Zacharias. That guy is worth driving all the way to Georgia to get to hear again. He's a great friend and has been on the program with us many times before. So certainly I hope that you will take the time to connect up with good news. And I hope that all of you have had a chance to fill these out, because I thought for just a minute before we get too far, I'll tell you that those of you that are winners will have a number of choices. First of all, we've got a number of my books out there. This is my most recent one, Making the Most of Your Money in Tough Times. We have one on Islam and spiritual warfare, and another is one of Marlon Maddox's books. So if you wanted a book to read and you were one of the winners, and I understand we're going to have a lot of winners tonight, so you'll get a chance to choose, that would be the case. But for those of you that have a computer and would want a Bible software, you might have heard us talk about this. We have actually worked with our good friends at Word Search, and this is a very sophisticated Bible software program. Especially for some of you youngsters out there, this is so incredible because it really allows you that if you are looking at a particular verse, you can then search, and then it will not only search all the Bible commentaries and all the Bible translations we have there, but it also includes all sorts of other books. Five of my most recent books, all of Marlon Maddox's books, books by, you know, all sorts of people, Tim LaHaye, Paul Copan, all sorts of apologists. I think we have a Ravi Zacharias one in there as well. And you just push the button and it happens simultaneously. And for some of you that are older, you're going to go, well, I still want my Bible. I understand that. But for you young people, you're used to using some of these things. Remember that one that just went off just a minute ago over Clarence, you know? And I'm finding more and more young people are studying God's Word on computers. And the other day, I told the story about this one mother who had purchased something for her kids like this. And then it was dinner time. Moms, you can relate to this, right? And she says, kids, come down for dinner. Kids, come down for dinner. After about the third time, she just storms up the stairs. She opens the door, and the kids are studying the Bible. It's like, well, I couldn't really get too upset about that. And so sometimes I'm finding these Bible software programs are very effective for those of us that want to do Bible study, but it also is a good way to get this younger generation into God's Word. So these, I'll put those back there, and you'll be able to choose those in a few minutes. And you also put down some questions. So in a little bit later, I'll kind of have some opening statements, and then you can ask some questions. We've got a microphone here. We'll go in the audience if you want to ask a question, or if you say, no, I wrote it down, and I don't want to stand up. I'm not a public speaker. They'll give me some questions, and I guess this will be sort of the Stump Kirby session, so we'll see what we can do with that. Is everybody ready to go? Well, what I want to try to do for tonight is to talk about trends, and I'm going to primarily focus on political trends and kind of demographic trends simply because that's what we talk about oftentimes on Point of View. But if you do come to the church tomorrow, we're going to turn on these video projectors here, and I'm going to do a shorter one on some trends we're noticing about the so-called millennial generation, those children born between 1980 and 2000. If you've noticed, in terms of their attendance in church, their dedication to biblical orthodoxy, lots of questions. And we, at my ministry that I begin my day with, Pro Ministries, have spent a lot of money with the Barna Group and have done the most extensive survey of this younger generation. And we are concerned and have developed programs to really begin to help churches and individuals turn this around. Because if we don't turn this around, I do believe that in the future, we will really be dealing with some very significant issues. Churches that exist right now, Christian organizations, missions that exist, might not exist 20 years from now. Or if they do, they may not be so vital. So that was what I'll be talking about in the first hour. Second hour, we're going to open up God's Word, talk about some of the things that we see in the nation of Israel, and what God was looking at there, in particular in the book of Isaiah, and comparing that to what we see in our nation as well. So if you have a chance to come out tomorrow, that's what we'll be doing. But tonight, I want to look at some of these political changes and trends. And as I do so, I recognize that I'm going to ruin your day. communion, because we're going to have to talk about some negative things. It's a little bit like I've been speaking on college campuses now for 37 years, and I heard the story the other day of this one student that went into the student health center, and he came in and said, well, I'm here to see Dr. Smith, and this angry-looking nurse said, down the hallway, two doors on the right, take off all your clothes. And he kind of stepped back and didn't know what to do with that, and so he said, well, you know, don't I need to fill out something? And she said, did you not hear me? I said, down the hallway, two doors on the right, take off all your clothes. Well, he thought, well, I'm going to just try one more time. He said, you know, it's just, you know, on my face. And she said, did you not get my message? You are supposed to go down that hallway, two doors on the right, take off all your clothes. And so he goes down there, opens up a door, and there's a naked guy sitting there. And he says, a naked guy, boy, a woman like that could just ruin your whole day. And he says, you're not kidding. I'm just the UPS delivery man. Well, I'm going to ruin your day. But I don't mean to. And we're going to look at some negative trends and positive trends. I'm going to end with positive. With bad news first, right? Well, the first one is pretty obvious. The economic trends that we're looking at in this country. We've got to be understanding that we as a country have managed to actually incur $16 trillion worth of debt. $16 trillion worth of debt. And that's just the on-the-record debt. For those of you that receive my daily commentary by email or listen to it sometimes, you know that I've even just more recently documented the fact that there's all sorts of off-the-book debt as well. But $16 trillion worth of debt. And it is doubtful that we are going to turn that around anytime soon. Because right now we are spending as a country about $3.8 trillion, but we're only bringing in about $2.5 trillion. And the other day, just trying to make that easier, Kelly Shackelford and I used an illustration. Imagine if you knew somebody that was spending $38,000 a year, but only bringing in $25,000 a year. They'd be falling behind $13,000 every single year, year after year after year. Let's say that maybe the husband and wife got together and said, you know, we've got to do something really significant. So they sit down and they come up with all sorts of ideas, and they're about ready to hit a fiscal cliff. And finally, somebody signs off and says, okay, we've actually begun to address this issue. We're going to save $150. And that's essentially what the fiscal cliff just did. I just rounded the zeros off here, and basically we have, and you would look at somebody and you would think that they had lost their mind when after spending $38,000 every year, bringing in only $25,000 a year, their solution was to figure out how to cut $150 off of your budget. Matter of fact, the example I used probably is more accurate, and that is they said, oh, well, I was going to buy this $400 iPad, but I decided to instead buy a cheaper iPad mini. And that's, you know, because even there, they're not actually cutting anything. You're just not deciding to spend as much as they were going to spend. Well, that's the world that we're in, and it is sad to see what we are giving to our children and grandchildren. I don't run my business that way. I don't run my ministry that way. I don't run my personal life that way. I don't think you do as well. But we continually elect people to Washington, D.C. that do that. The other part of that economic issue is, well, don't you think we should maybe cut some spending? If you're, you know, making $25,000 but spending $38,000, maybe you need to bring that down to $25,000. But the other day, apparently reported in the Wall Street Journal, when John Boehner raised that with our president, the president said, we don't have a spending problem. Now, I don't know if that was just to shut him up or whether he believes it. The first one means he was dishonest. The second one means we have really a deluded person in the Oval Office, because that's exactly what we have. But more to the point, I think he understands, and members of Congress seem to understand, that a lot of Americans really don't want to cut spending too much. After all, this came out just the other day from the American Enterprise Institute. When we look at this right now, 70% of Americans receive some kind of government aid, 70%. Now, that's apples and oranges, because some of those people, for example, receiving Social Security, they paid into Social Security, they deserve to get it back. They've served in the military, they deserve veterans' benefits. I understand that. But the point is, whatever you talk about cutting agriculture, the farmers jump forward. You talk about cutting defense, as we might have to do. Defense contractors jump forward. You talk about beginning to revise entitlements, people that are on fixed incomes. And you can see that we are in a problem that isn't going to be easily resolved. The other aspect of that is to recognize an illustration that I use in this book that comes from Warren Buffett. I don't quote from Warren Buffett very often, but let's quote from Warren Buffett for just a minute. And he uses a very good example. He says, imagine that you have two isolated islands. One island that we will refer to as Thriftville, and the other island which we refer to as Squanderville. Now, these two islands are at subsistence level, but the people in Thriftville begin to produce additional goods and services, and the people in Squanderville say, well, we would be glad to buy some of those goods and services from you because then we don't have to work so hard. So they actually issue to them squander bonds to begin to purchase some of those additional gifts and services. Well, over time, everybody seems pretty happy. Thriftville is producing more and more, and they're getting these squander bonds. And Squanderville's thrilled because they don't have to work quite so hard. But then the people in Thriftville begin to say, wait a minute, it's quite possible that those squander bonds, they're just sort of like IOUs. They might default on those IOUs. So they decide to denominate those squander bonds into squander bucks, and then they use those squander bucks at Thriftville to go and buy the land and the machinery and the factories in Thriftville. And over time, eventually, Thriftville owns all of Squanderville. Now, when I give that illustration, or when Warren Buffett gives that illustration, a lot of times you want to ask, who do you think Thriftville is? China, usually. Saudi Arabia, Japan. Does anybody have to guess who Squanderville is? And this, I think, illustrates the fact that we are facing some very significant challenges. And I could go on and on and on about the bad news, but I've even had a few of you say, you know, I can only listen to about a 1 or 2 hours of point of view because it's so serious, it kind of wears me out. Let's talk about some of the positive things that are happening that might eventually give us the chance of turning this around. And the first is to begin to recognize that there is a remarkable realignment in America taking place, as best illustrated by something that was evaluated a number of years ago, and that is that various moving companies began to evaluate where people were moving, as well as Ryder and U-Haul and others were evaluating where people were moving. For example, I was born in California. As many of you know, I was born in Berkeley, California. Berkeley, California, not Augusta, Georgia. Okay, really different. But I have to say that right now I live in Texas, but we have found something very interesting. If you want to rent a truck and go from Texas to California, or you want to move from Texas to California, it is cheaper than if you want to move from California to Texas. Why is that? Because everybody's leaving California. Why? Taxes. And this is something that people have begun to notice rather dramatically, because as you begin to look at the movement taking place right now, people are moving from high tax states to low tax states. More specifically, people are moving from states that have a state income tax to one that has no income tax at all. If you begin to look at some of those remarkable realignments, and United Van Lines, I found that, for example, that more people are moving out of the state of Michigan than any other state. No surprise there. But interestingly enough, number two on that list was North Dakota up until a few years ago. Then they've had an energy boom. But if you go back and look at the states people are moving to, a high percentage of people are moving to South Dakota. Now, just the other day, I was corresponding with one of my friends who used to be in Texas, and now he's in Fargo, North Dakota. He had sent me a picture of his iPhone, and it showed minus 17 degrees at 5 a.m. in the morning. That's pretty cold, right? But nevertheless, people are moving from North Dakota in record numbers, but they're moving to South Dakota. Now, I've spoken on universities both in North Dakota and South Dakota. I've been all sorts of the Black Hills and everything. I've got to tell you, the two states are pretty much identical when you get right down to it, especially in the winter. But there's a real difference. There's an income tax in North Dakota. There's no income tax in South Dakota. If you look at the states into which people are moving right now, almost without exception, they're moving into these low-tax states. We're also starting to see a remarkable shift from the Sun Belt into the South, for example. We see, for example, people moving from the Snow Belt to the Sun Belt. But here's something interesting. Dallas now is larger than San Francisco. Houston is larger than Boston. Charlotte is now larger than Milwaukee. And so in a result, people are moving from those states into others. Did you notice this in the last census? You picked up a member of Congress. In Texas, we picked up four. Arizona picked up one. They're all moving to those states. And as a result, oftentimes they've left a high-tax state, come to a low-tax state, and said, wait a minute, this is not such a bad idea. Now, others have begun to document something else rather dramatically when you start looking at the differences between the different states. Those states that have a right-to-work laws actually produce economically almost two times as much in terms of their state GDP, or state, it'd be G, you know, domestic productions in that state, compared to those which have compulsory unionism. If you look at those particular states which require that you have compulsory unionism for government workers, those have a lower productivity than those that do not. This last year, did you remember what happened in Wisconsin? Remember Governor Scott Walker up there and what's been happening in Ohio and other places? You're starting to see a remarkable shift taking place. Now, at the same time, you recognize sometimes Yankees move down to Georgia and then they bring the Yankee values. But after about a generation, they sort of assimilate and say, you know, this isn't so bad after all. And so you're starting to see a patchwork quilt. You know, we used to be the United States of America. Today, we're sort of the divided states of America. I'm not just talking about things like red and blue states. Look at the states, for example, that have same-sex marriage. And those states which have 32 different states have a constitutional amendment in their state constitution codifying marriages between one man and one woman. Look at those states that have legalized marijuana. Maybe you don't want to look at those states. But, I mean, you can begin to see that we are very, very divided. And one of the most interesting articles that came out recently in the Wall Street Journal is, are we headed for some kind of social civil war? It may not be like the civil war we had in the 19th century, but we really do see some remarkable changes and divisions taking place. That's good news for those of us, for example, that have pro-life, pro-family convictions. Another good example of that could be that we, in about a week or so, are going to celebrate the 40th anniversary of Roe versus Wade. Now, some are going to celebrate it in the sense that they think it's a good idea. Others are going to commemorate it in terms of the loss of all those children. But the point I'm making is something unexpected happened. If you were to go back into time, and we'll do more of this tomorrow in church, and you were to ask people in 1973 or maybe by 1976 or certainly by 1980 what they would have predicted for the 40th anniversary of Roe versus Wade, the prediction would have been universal, and that is, certainly those who were pro-abortion, but even a fair number of people that are pro-life said, if we don't turn this around quickly, eventually you'll have a whole generation growing up that accepts abortion as normative. They will never have known a time when abortion was illegal. So they would assume that after 40 years, it would have been locked into place. Well, if you look at the states, you recognize that every single election, pro-life candidates and pro-life legislation has been successful. At the national level, doesn't look so good. I understand that. But the point I'm making is that now, on the anniversary of Roe versus Wade, we actually see more and more people every year as a percentage declare themselves as pro-life. And here's something that's even more interesting. The younger you are, the more likely you are to be pro-life. Planned Parenthood never saw that coming. Now, you might wonder, why is that the case? Well, there's a couple of good reasons. First of all, this is a generation that has, in a sense, had a window to the womb. Tomorrow, I'll talk a little bit more about the fact that we have twice as many crisis pregnancy centers, pregnancy resource centers, as we have abortion clinics in America. And that education has gone out there. We've had sonograms and other things. So education has educated this generation, and they certainly have been educated about the fact that there is human life inside the womb. But there's a second demographic reason for that. We've had almost 60 million abortions since Roe versus Wade. But they have not been universal across the population. You are more likely to be aborted in a pro-choice home than you were in a pro-life home. And so as a result, pro-life families are producing. First of all, pro-life families have more children. Have you noticed that? Go to your church nursery. Have you noticed this at all? Christians have more children than others. And so you are seeing that, in a sense, we are breeding and creating and bringing into the world, whatever word you want to use, we are actually dominating the political realm with pro-life individuals who have come from pro-life homes. And so we're beginning to see some remarkable changes taking place there as well. So again, we actually, I think, have to ask, in light of that, maybe that also explains a little bit more about why this particular administration has been trying to use every crisis they can use in order to bring things about. You know, there's this constant drumbeat that we've had over the last 4 years. We've got to do it now. We've got to do it now. We've got to implement this now. We've got to have this executive order now. And that's because they're looking at the same demographics that those of us that are pro-life, pro-family are looking at. And that is, the winds are really blowing the other direction. Now, you would not know that if you went to my hometown of Berkeley, California. You would not know that if you went to Boulder, Colorado. You may not notice that if you go to New York City. But you know what? You notice it when you go almost everywhere else in the country. As a matter of fact, if it weren't for the corners of the country, this country would be much more conservative than it is right now. And those individuals do have a disproportionate amount of influence. Individuals that are in the university tend to be more likely to be liberal or progressive than conservative. But some of that's changing. Certainly people in the media tend to be more liberal or progressive than conservative. But some of that is changing. But nevertheless, they, again, are looking at these same kinds of demographics and recognizing that actually some winds are blowing in the other direction. Let's just take one example, the birth rate. This is something that both liberals and conservatives have been talking about. Arthur Brooks is a conservative. He's been on my program before. He wrote a book a while back about the fertility gap. And Philip Longman is about as liberal as the day is long, but nevertheless, he wrote a book called The Empty Cradle. But whether you look at Philip Longman, a liberal, or Arthur Brooks, a conservative, they both have concluded something dramatic. And that is that if you went out here right now, or certainly in America, and you just began to talk to 100 politically liberal adults who were not related to one another, they would among them have about 147 children. But if you then went out and talked to 100 politically conservative individuals who were not related to one another, they would have 208 children. That is a fertility gap of 41%. Now, it doesn't take very long to recognize that conservatives are producing more children than liberals. Now, let me, as a subsite before I go any further, it also is true that Christians are producing more children than secularists. Pro-life people are producing more children, as I mentioned just a minute ago, than pro-choice people. So these trends are breaking all over the place simultaneously. But as Arthur Brooks points out, there is, if you will, a birth dearth among liberal families. So what has happened is that there are more children that are growing up in politically conservative homes that hold to traditional values, tend to vote more likely pro-life, pro-family, tend to vote more Republican than Democrat, all those kinds of variations that you would see there. And so as a result, as you play this out, it's beginning to change the percentages. Take one example. We broadcast in a couple of radio stations in Ohio. Whenever I go to Ohio, I think of it as the classic purple state. It's sort of neither red nor blue. And it was interesting that both President Obama and former Governor Mitt Romney spent a lot of time in Ohio. And Ohio is pretty much of a 50-50 state, but it's starting to trend and it's starting to become 52-48. Some people believe that by the next presidential election could be 55-45, and it will no longer be a purple state. Let's look at my home state, where I was born, California, land of the fruit and the nuts, okay? Barbara Boxer and Dianne Feinstein are the senators. Need I say any more? We've been talking about guns issues. I suspect one of the questions might be on that subject tonight. But again, even though that is a state which is pretty much 55-45, because you have a fair number of conservatives in the Central Valley and in the South, still the liberals in the North and along the coast dominate. But again, it's eventually possible, even as this begins to play out, that it could eventually be a 50-50 state. When I grew up in California, my father ran for the California Assembly. He lost that year because Richard Nixon was running as governor and they both lost. 2 years later, he ran again, but he lost, but so did Barry Goldwater because he was running for president. But then 2 years after that, something happened. A guy by the name, I think his name was Ronald Reagan. Anybody remember who he was? He was elected in the state of California. I would suggest to you right now, Ronald Reagan could not be elected in the state of California. But I would suggest that if this trend continues on, it's possible someone like he, Ronald Reagan, could be elected in California. Now, there are some caveats, two very important ones. First of all, we recognize that it's about an 80-20, that if a child grows up in a conservative home, there's an 80% chance that he or she will be conservative when they grow up. But that percentage can be driven down by the university. This is a kind of a mechanism that we've created in our society to turn Christian kids into secular kids, conservative kids into liberal kids. So it sometimes depends on whether or not they're rooted in their faith or in their convictions before they go off to college. Those that do continue on. Those that don't sometimes fade away. So that's one thing that is certainly possibly affecting this ratio that we're seeing and has had some impact. The second one is, you know where I'm going, immigration. That is, more and more people that are coming here who do not assimilate in our society, but if nothing else, come here for benefits or come here because they believe that Democratic Party or liberal progressive policies are going to be better for their family, can change some of that as well. So I recognize that some of those trends are changing and can be changed, but I think it illustrates only so well that even in the midst of a lot of negative news, we're starting to see some remarkable changes taking place. In even this last election, we saw a number of state legislatures that used to be Democratic, now Republican. We used to see a number of governors that were Democrat replaced by Republican. By the way, I'm not convinced that Republicans are all good and Democrats are all bad, but that's the point I'm trying to make, is that it's more likely if you have concerns about pro-life, pro-family issues. Yes, I do know of pro-life Democrats, and we have some of them in the South, but very few. But you don't have very many of them at the national level. When Nancy Pelosi tells everybody in the Democratic Party in the House of Representatives what to do, not much of a chance you're going to get much pro-life legislation or anything of that nature. And I'm not so convinced the Republican Party is always so good, because I know a lot of them that are, what do we call them, rhinos, Republicans in name only. So I'm not saying one's good, one's bad, but I am saying that if you want to move forward traditional family values, you want to move for fiscal conservative values, you want to limit the size and scope of government, there are a number of trends pretty much on the background right now, but I think, in a sense, these are waves that are going to start crashing on the shore of America and have at least the potential to be remarkably changing our society. That being said, I think anybody that's realistic has to say we don't see any willingness on the part of at least this president or even certain members of Congress to change what we're doing. And you have to ask the fundamental question, have we kicked the can down the road so long that now we've run out of road? And I think that's going to be the fundamental question over these next couple of years. We hope that we don't end up looking like some of these other countries. I all the time have people say, well, are we going to look like Greece? And I do talk about that a little bit in the book, because after all, we are making decisions that we should not have made. And really, the thesis of this book, and it's just one I happen to have in my hand, but many of these others talk about these ideas as well, is that we have, in a relatively short period of time, changed America in ways that nobody would have anticipated. If you go back to 1980, the accumulated national debt from George Washington to the end of Jimmy Carter's administration was approximately the same amount that we passed in the first stimulus bill. So that shows you that up until that period of time, we were just a little under $1 trillion. By the time Ronald Reagan left, it was $2 trillion, but still somewhat manageable. But at 1980, you could still say, even though we had a little less than $1 trillion in national debt, you could still say that we were the largest creditor nation in the history of the world. What can we say now? We're the largest debtor nation in the history of the world. And so corporately, we did this to ourselves. What about individually? Well, if you go back and individually look in 1980, the best estimates I can come up with that I document in my book are that we as Americans at that time still were a nation of savers. that the average American probably saved about 10% of their discretionary income in the 1980s. That number has now gone into the negative numbers and now is kind of just back at zero. So again, both individually and collectively, we've made some remarkable changes in America. And so I think it brings us back to the need for us to think more biblically about economics and about these various issues. And frankly, if I can put in just a little commercial for Point of View, that's what we're all about. Hope that you listen from 2 o'clock to 4 o'clock every day. If you don't, certainly visit the website and download the podcast so you can listen to it later, because we do believe that it's important today to educate. And we're given, and I'm going to talk more about this tomorrow morning, really recognizing that as important as radio is, that as will be and always will be the foundation of Point of View, but we're trying to find other ways to get the information out. A lot of these young people here probably don't listen to the radio station, or if they do, they listen to it on this. Matter of fact, you go to pointofview.net with your smartphone, you'll know that it's already tailored so that you can listen to it on your smartphone. They're more likely to listen to it there. They're more likely to get some of these facts and figures from Facebook and MySpace and Pinterest and YouTube and all sorts of things. So we're really recognizing how important it is to take this radio ministry that we've been doing for many years now with Good News and other networks and to expand that in other forms of media. I promised that I would speak for about a half an hour, and I have done so. So let us, if we can, see if there are any other questions that any of you want to turn in. And I notice Mark's heading back there, so I'm going to turn it into a question-answer period, and we can do it in two ways. Number one, if you wanted to ask a question, we've got a microphone here, and I think you can grab that microphone. And number two, we can also have, every once in a while, if everybody's shy, have them put me on the spot and ask me a question. And so I'm going to turn it around for some questions for a few minutes, and I think you have some announcements.
Right. What we're going to do is I'm going to read these names real fast, and don't go far, Mr. Anderson, because I'm going to hand these over to you. These are winners that have some questions as well. But these are the names that after we're done, if you would just walk to the back and see Brian or Dan, and they'll get the material for you. Barry Fleming, Stan Salter, Bruce Hayslip, Jane Payne, Ruth, I get something from my dad, and that's pronounced instead of Ruth Nix, maybe, Kay Lean, Linda Edwards, Phil Alexander, Abdel Saeed, Beth Asman, Badger, last name Badger, I'm sorry, I said no Baranowskis, but there's a Joyce Baranowski. That's my aunt, so she's approved. Paul Beggs, Tina Bennett, Charlene Boudet, Elizabeth Britt, Pamela Bug, Vincent Burdett, Angeline Busby, Beverly Butler, Jeffrey Chu, Agatha Davis, Reverend Nathan Dean, Irene there you go. Lynn Eldridge, John and Robin Fellows, Laurel Guffey, Brenda Hayslip, Betty Hammett, Lana Hardiman, Beverly Hensley, Beverly Jones, John Jones, Mary Kaufman, Tina Lewis, Robert Loki, Larry Marioli, Karen McConnell, James McKinney, Helen McKinney, Jim and Cindy Meeks, Michael Mixon, Richard Moore, Jessica Morris, Joey Mullis, Lee O'Neill, that's my cousin's son, he's approved too, Teresa Osborne, Brenda Ramsey, Linda Salter, Mike Schleenbacher, that's worse than Baranowski, Ken Smith, we got two Ken Smiths here, this is Ken and Diane, they're on here too, Dwayne Starenberg, Gerard Starenberg, Barbara Stewart, Chuck Tatum, Karen Thomas, Denise Thomas. We did this so your voice could rest. Reverend Wayne Tudell, Todd, Nancy Todd, Jill Urban, Brian, you're paying for this Monday morning. That's all I'm telling you. Kim White, Evelyn Winsett, Philip Winsett, John Wolf, Courtney Wolf, Rick and Beverly Reitzman, Karen Yurchek, and I think this is Diane Word, is that right? Shoreline Drive. Right, okay. All right, so those, after we're done, can go back and see Mr. Brian or Mr. Dan, and here are some questions as well if you want to look through those, and then Glenn has the microphone.
Take those back there.
So I'll take these back there.
Just out of curiosity, raise your hand. How many won? Yeah. Oh, I was going to say, I think just about everybody won. So, first of all, don't ever say I've never won anything, because you just did. Yes, that's just amazing. Okay, so these are a few questions here. And first of all, does anybody want to ask a question from the floor? Because I will sort of get a microphone over here, and while we're doing that... this is a simple one while you're getting over there. You know, your program stimulates thinking and much conversation for people to air concerns. How do you measure actions? And that has always been a difficulty for any of us in radio. There's a couple of ways you can. Obviously, when we have a call to action, for example, calling your member of Congress or contacting your member of Congress, we've been able to measure it in those ways. Sometimes we don't do petitions. I think we've done one or two. Sometimes that's a way. But that is always a little bit of a difficulty. But we certainly have lots of anecdotal stories over the years. One of the things I like to do from time to time is, and Clarence, again, thank you for inviting me to do this, I get to meet some of you, and I've met individuals that have decided to run for Congress because they've heard the program. As you may have heard us mention before, Michelle Bachmann, who we knew when she was just a homemaker and then one day called into the program and was doing something in Minnesota on education, later decided to run for Congress. I think you've heard of her. Kelly Shackelford actually was a student at Baylor Law School in Waco and heard the program that Marlon did and then later that I was doing and thought maybe going into this area of law would be a really good idea. And maybe that's something I could do, and of course we can tell that story. I can't tell you the number of people I've talked over the years that have started pregnancy resource centers. Any of you that are in the pro-life movement or working with a pregnancy center, bless you, what a great ministry. And again, a lot of those have happened. The number of parents I've run into that said I've homeschooled my kids because I learned about what was taught in the public schools. So there's some ways to measure it, but it isn't as easy with radio, but certainly we have some of those. But now I think we're ready for a question here. While you're doing that, I'll look at my next question here.
Hello? Yeah. Good evening, everybody. Kirby, thank you so much for coming down here. Listen to you all day long as I can as I'm working. Really two things. One, I want to know about the union situation. I'll be more specific in just a moment. But something that you were saying about the migration of people moving out of the different states, have we looked at any information to find out, is it retirees? Is it conservative people leaving these tax states to come? Is it liberals as well as conservatives looking for new job opportunities? And then the one for the unions, I believe it was in Michigan, where they can now opt out.
Right.
I want to know how the people that are union members are comfortable. What do they have to do to opt out? Is it like they're sending out new ballots saying, if you want to join, you sign again? So that they're not intimidated is what I'm looking at.
Okay, a couple questions. First of all, you said, you know, what about the complexion of people moving? Well, the most significant studies, interestingly enough, matter of fact, the one that was huge was done by United Van Lines because they were just simply trying to figure out where people were moving and recognizing that, you know, 20,000 people move every single day in America. Isn't that an amazing number? But they don't move uniformly. They move to different places. So we don't have as good a study as I would like in terms of why they moved, but I think you can figure out that sometimes they vote with their feet when they move from states that have a state income tax to states that don't have an income tax. A good example in California, lots and lots of people have been moving from California to Nevada. Matter of fact, one of the most significant exoduses, if you will, of the Asian population has been Asians who used to be in California. Because a lot of people that from the Asian countries come over to the United States, they more likely will live in Washington or especially California. But they're finding a mass exodus of Asians from California. California to Nevada. Now, are they moving simply because Nevada feels more like Japan or China? Don't think so. So obviously, you've got to believe that the economic reasons are there. Probably regulations are reasons there as well. Now, for the issue of the unions, yes, it depends on which state you're in, and I don't know enough about Georgia to probably be conversant about that. But in many places, yes, you can opt out of that, or you can even in some states designate that your various fees do not go for a political action committee, because oftentimes people are saying, I'm in a union, and they're using money to elect a candidate that I would disagree with or to promote a program that I disagree with. Now, that's true for various kinds of unions, and some of them have to do with government unions. Some are, of course, teachers' unions, so it's kind of a mixed bag there. But we've done some programs in the past to try to explain that. But if you wanted to know specifically about what is available, I would encourage you to contact the National Right to Work Foundation. It's called National Right to Work Foundation in Washington, D.C. They can give you all the specifics and also whether or not you have various conscience protections within your particular union. That would be the best way to get that information. Let me take another one. Anybody put up a hand while we're looking? Okay, hand over there, but while we're looking. Talk about the death panels in Obamacare. I'm 88 years of age. And this was something that got Michelle Bachmann in a lot of trouble because she called them death panels. But it's very clear that if you look at some of the research that has been published over the last few years in medical journals, and I've had a chance to look at some of them, some of them published, interestingly enough, by the brother of Rahm Emanuel, who is now the mayor of Chicago but was in the Obama administration. His brother and many others have argued that we, in a society where we have scarce medical resources, need to implement something that looks like triage. What's triage? Well, if you've ever been in the military or you've ever maybe watched MASH or other shows about the military, oftentimes what they do is they will, as the various victims come in, the casualties come in, they'll put them in one of three categories, hence the French word triage for three. They will put those aside who have superficial wounds that can be treated later. They will then see in that second category those individuals that have wounds that if they don't treat them immediately, they will die and treat them. And they put a third category of those people whose wounds are so significant that they just simply let them die. And the argument has been made that given the fact that we have scarce medical resources, you know, every year the percentage that we spend on medical devices and medicine in general compared to GDP goes up. And so the argument that is coming from individuals, first proposed by, at that time, Hillary Clinton with Hillary Care, and now being proposed by President Obama and others through Obamacare, is that we have to begin to evaluate the effectiveness of various kinds of treatments. Now, if you want to know what that looks like, go to the state of Oregon. In Oregon, first of all, they have physician-assisted suicide, and they actually have established criteria. Those treatments where you have the best cost benefit, you get the most bang for your buck, all the way down to those which are seen as maybe a ridiculous or worthless investment of medical resources. And that kind of criteria is now being put together by a panel that has been in existence for some time. It's not like Obamacare created it. They just simply took the existing one at NIH and empowered it with more responsibility. Way to show that it's already acting, do any of you remember a couple of years ago where they were saying, maybe we shouldn't have as many mammograms? Remember that? Okay, that came from that panel saying, you know, it may not make as much sense to always have women have mammograms before a certain age or to have mammograms regularly because we might get too many false positives, which will cause us to have to do additional research, additional expenses, and so they're making a cost-benefit judgment and deciding, you know, it's probably better for you not to have mammograms so often or before a certain age. For the men, maybe you remember just 2 years ago, that same panel decided that maybe not having a prostate exam would be a good idea because, again, we get some false positives and then they do additional tests and it's more expensive. We'll recognize that by this time next year, if Obamacare is implemented, there are going to be lots of pressures that already exist, but they're going to be maximized now to try to control cost, because you're going to bring in millions of uninsured people into the system. I think we're going to just jam up our emergency rooms like we've never seen before. But more importantly, there's going to be a lot of pressure to begin to say, we just can't afford to treat you if you have, you know, cancer of certain sorts, if you're over a certain age, or if certain treatments aren't going to be effective. And so even though I think some people have overreacted to the idea of calling them death panels, they are making decisions about what is an effective treatment and what is an ineffective treatment. And if you want to, again, understand that, in this country, look at the state of Oregon. If you want to have a better example, look at the NHS in the UK. You'll have a good example there as well. Question.
Okay. I remember growing up as a kid about 100 miles south of Chicago, and I remember the abortion debate was starting because they were always saying the back alley abortions and the women are dying and all this, and the poor have to go to Mexico. I just remember that, and I just wanted to put that out there. That's how the media shapes it. It might take years, but that's how they start shaping it. So anyway, but my question is, how do you feel on the tax exempt status for churches? How is that impacting how pastors see their ability to address whatever the government doesn't like? Because we hear it, it says, oh, you can't talk about that. But then when in Sunday school classes, whenever it's taught that we're supposed to submit ourselves to authority, which I agree, but then I always ask, well, then how did the Revolutionary War come about? And everybody draws a blank face because they don't see how it was justified, how the pastors who were leading or influencing the Revolutionary War, how they went about it. What's your thoughts? And specifically, is there, do you feel like pastors are fearful of losing tax-exempt status?
Right. Good questions. And there's a couple, so I'll try to pull them all together. Hopefully you could follow this logic as best we can. First of all, the possibility that a church would lose a tax-exempt status for even being political is pretty rare. Matter of fact, non-existent. There was one church back in 1992 that published a full-page ad in USA Today saying that voting for Bill Clinton was against the will of God. And that church, for one day, lost its tax-exempt status. It was reinstituted. So that's much more blatant than I think most churches would take. So first of all, the fear that you hear from pastors, will we lose our tax-exempt status? No, that is not the case. The bigger concern has to do with something that was implemented in the state I live in now, the state of Texas, in 1954. In 1954, Lyndon Johnson was able to slip into the IRS code a statement that said that a 501c3 nonprofit tax-exempt organization, which could be a Christian organization or a church, cannot be involved in politics. And there has been a real attempt over these many years to try to reverse that in the courts. And you might know that Alliance Defense Fund, now called Alliance Defending Faith, has actually encouraged pastors to preach political sermons from the pulpit, then take those sermons, reprint them, and send them to the IRS, hoping the IRS would challenge that. Then that would give them standing so that they could bring the case. By the way, the churches have never been investigated by the IRS. But that 1954 case really had nothing to do with churches. It had everything to do with Lyndon Johnson. Now, to understand that, you have to go back 6 years. In 1948, Lyndon Johnson won in a very close race. They called him Landslide Lyndon. Because, I know this will surprise you, but voter fraud did exist even back then and still exists to this day. There was one precinct, for example, where when they looked at the ballots, everybody voted in complete and perfect alphabetical order. And there were all sorts of people that voted that we weren't even sure were alive when they voted. And I was reminded of this recently because I did something with William F. Buckley. Many of you might remember William F. Buckley, Jr. with National Review. I did something with him before he died in Dallas, and I picked him up at the airport. And he spoke that night, and we introduced him, and he said, you know, it's fun to be back in Texas. Last time I was in Texas, I had something kind of interesting happen, and that is when I was in West Texas, speaking, I was in the town where my great uncle had been. And so a lot of people told me something I did know, and that is my great uncle had actually been the sheriff in that town. But then they told me something I did not know, and that is 5 years after my great uncle died, he voted for Lyndon Johnson. And so Lyndon Johnson was not sure he was going to win re-election in 1954. And the Hunt brothers, Lamar Hunt and Munger Hunt, were very much involved in an anti-communist crusade. So they were actually producing all sorts of literature against Lyndon Johnson. And so to shut them down, he slipped this in to silence any nonprofit 501c3, organization. But back to the point, I don't think the churches should be fearful that they would lose their tax-exempt status. As I just illustrated a minute ago, there are pastors actually giving very political sermons, sending them to the IRS, and nobody's ever been challenged. But let's go back to your other point. How did we get into the American Revolution? And if you go back and look at a very important essay written by John Adams. Now, who was John Adams? Well, John Adams, first of all, was our first vice president, and he was later president. He was our second president. He was also the father of the president later on. First time we had a president whose son was also a president. But in 1818, he talked about those individuals that were very important in the American Revolution. And one of the names he mentions is Reverend Jonathan Mayhew. Now, I will suggest to you, if I go to Georgia Tech, I go to University of Georgia, and I talk to history professors, and I say, who were the men most responsible for the American Revolution? They're going to be saying, well, George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, maybe Samuel Adams. I bet most of them wouldn't even know who Jonathan Mayhew is. Well, Jonathan Mayhew, actually, years before the American Revolution, preached a sermon on civil disobedience. Is there ever a time when we should disobey government? One of your other questions here had to be about this as well. Is there ever a time when Christians, because they are forced by government to do something which, if obeyed, would cause them to violate Scripture, is there ever a time for them to disobey? Now, that sermon was then reprinted, and it was spread all over England, first New England, and then all over the eastern seaboard, and went over to England. There was even threats on his life and everything. And his argument was very simple. If we look at Scripture, what do we see? Do we see any civil disobedience in the Old Testament? Okay, and some of the examples he used are the Hebrew midwives that saved Moses. He spends a lot of time in the book of Daniel, right? Because, you know, eat meat sacrificed to idols, sacrificed to the king, maybe it wasn't kosher. Daniel in the lion's den, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. In the New Testament, Acts 5:29, we would obey God rather than men. So is there a place for civil disobedience? I would have to say right now, my good friend David Green, who's the head of Hobby Lobby, says, yes, there is. When the government specifically requires you to do something with which, if you obey it, would violate biblical standards, that's very different. Now, David Green and Hobby Lobby, for example, 13,500 employees do provide contraceptives if the employees want them. They do pay minimum wage far above what is required. They do give their employees Sunday off, but they cannot bring themselves to provide even a penny to abortifacients, which would be Plan B, the so-called morning after pill, or Ella, the week after pill. And so right now, they are accumulating, are you ready for this? $1.3 million fines every single day because they fined them $100 per employee. They got 13,000 employees. You can do the math. So is there ever a time when civil disobedience would be appropriate? Yes, but we have to be real careful. There's some people who want to pull the trigger. I don't like that president, so I'm going to disobey. No, we are told in Scripture that we are to obey those in authority. We're to pray for those in authority. But at the same time, if directly and specifically required to do something by the government, that we're called upon to do something which, if done, would be sinful, then I think we exercise civil disobedience. Which relates to another question. Next hand, go up as you're looking for a microphone. Some people say, do you think the church here would ever be persecuted? Well, right now we're fortunate in that we face persecution with a small p. But if you listen to Point of View this week, you know we've talked about persecution with a capital P in other countries. believers in North Korea, in China, Afghanistan, in Sudan, in Nigeria, in Mali, are facing a level of persecution, because there it's either obey the government or obey God. Fortunately, we have a middle road where we can bring about changes so that we don't have to face that choice. But again, is it possible? Well, Dr. Erwin Lutzer is thinking about writing a book right now about how the church needs to be ready for persecution. I hope he's wrong. Many of you may have read a book by a good friend of mine, Eric Metaxas, on Bonhoeffer, another powerful book, just to remind us. But I think we have another question back here, so let me take one of those.
I guess one comment on civil disobedience, and I guess I see it at a point where citizens don't have a way to regress grievances. You know, say, for instance, we push the envelope and the president governs by executive order.
Yeah.
And you know, we may be heading that way this year. So that's just one thing to watch out for, I think.
Yeah. And I think we have impeachment. We have, you know, all sorts of other things that could be done if it got that extreme. I don't know that it will, but it's something to think about. And back to your point, redress of grievances. You know, in the Declaration of Independence, they say that when there's been a long train of abuses and usurpations, sometimes friends of mine in the Tea Party movement, others, you know, they pull the trigger too quickly. I mean, it's kind of like we have to sort of been argued into civil disobedience, because the warp and woof of Scripture says that we are to obey those in government. And when Paul was writing that, Nero was in power. And when Peter writes that in 1 Peter 2, you know, whether it's Romans 13, 1-7, or whether it's 1 Peter 2, both of those passages that talk about us obeying government were written at a time when, if you think we have a bad leader, go back and look at what it was like in Rome at that time. And so I think the emphasis is we are to obey those in authority, but when we are specifically commanded to do something, when there's been a long train of abuses, that's what finally caused the patriots, the founders and framers of our government, to exercise that. And there's even a question among Christians whether or not they were biblically justified, so we'll leave that alone.
My question being is regarding trends. You know, I look back, it's really a trend looking at us, United States, looking at an earlier Europe, as far as they were leaders, you know, in the 1800s, industrialized world, intellectually, you know, and in the church realm, you know, leaders, evangelicals. And now we look at Europe, and it's pitiful. But is that coming our way? Are we trending as they have?
Well, and again, this is something that's kind of intriguing. I'll talk a little bit about this tomorrow morning if we have time. I recognize I'll have to be fairly short. But there are two things happening simultaneously in this country, and that is you do still have a fair amount of Christian dynamism. Lots of people go to church. But at the same time, the fastest growing demographic segment for those millennials are those people who actually commit themselves in a survey to atheist, agnostic, or no preference. So on the one hand, we still have lots of churches. We still have lots of Christians giving to missions. We have very stable and in many cases even growing churches and Christian colleges and things of that nature. But at the same time, if you were to look at that trend, there are certain aspects of our culture that look a lot more like Europe. And I could take you out of Georgia into New York or into California or to places in Colorado, and it would feel a lot more like Europe. Now, what does that mean? Well, I hope that it means that we might need a revival. After all that you've heard here, you ready for a revival? Maybe a reformation. We've had a first great awakening, a second great awakening. We really need a third great awakening. And that is possible. As a matter of fact, Joel Rosenberg's been on my program many times, and I said this in a recent commentary. Are we a Jonah generation? Or are we a Nahum generation? Remember Jonah? You know, he ends up in Nineveh. Has kind of a whale of a tale to tell when he gets there, but nevertheless shows up there. And the king instantaneously hears that message and repents. He removes his robes. He puts on sackcloth. He sits in ashes. He calls for everyone to repent. And God spares Nineveh. More than 100 years later, if you read Nahum, they don't. And God brings judgment. So I don't know if we're a Jonah or a Nahum nation, but I do believe that we need a revival. But if you look at the body of Christ, as we've said this week, even when we talked about persecuted Christians, the church is growing incredibly in Africa and in Asia. And is it possible that God used Europe and sent all those great missionaries from Europe and then moved over to the United States, and we've sent all those great missionaries, and now maybe God's hand moves somewhere else? I hope not. But, you know, God is not dependent on the United States of America. Frankly, God's not dependent on anyone in this room. God wants to use us, and if we're available to him, we will. But you also have to ask the question about judgment. This came up with the Newtown shooting. You know, I'm not so sure that you can make a real good case that when we have a crisis, an earthquake, a shooting, although some people have tried to correlate that, that that's all of God's judgment. But you have to say that if you go back and look at how God judged the nation of Israel, how God judged Sodom and Gomorrah, if God doesn't judge the United States of America, as some people have said, maybe he owes an apology to Sodom and Gomorrah. We're doing things that no other nation has ever done. I mean, we have aborted 60 million unborn. We have now at least have, we're going to get to a point, I think, within the next election, maybe a dozen states that legalize same-sex marriage. We normalize that in ways that even the Greeks and Romans didn't do. So it's something to think about. Does that mean that God's bringing judgment? I'm not going to say that, but I'm not going to ignore it either. Let's see if there's other hands that want to go up. And I recognize a few of you might have to leave early, and I'm used to people walking out on me all the time. So if you have to walk out, and make sure you get your, if you're a winner, one of your opportunities. Let's take a couple more, and when somebody starts doing this, I'll know that we need to end. But let's take the call, the question over there.
Okay, this is a little bit more controversial. This is about replacement theology. A little over a week ago, you had a caller named Pastor Bob call in and quoted 2 Chronicles 7:14.
Yeah.
Misquoted. It says, "And my people who are called by my name." Okay, this is, if you read it in context, it's obviously a covenant between God and Israel.
Right.
And you normally are quick to set people straight when they are misquoting something. You didn't this time. I was just wondering why.
Sure. And sometimes I just don't pick a fight with everybody that calls in. You know, there's... you know, a number of years ago, I had J.P. Moreland on my program. He's at Biola. And I learned a lesson from him, because any caller that had even just a slightly different theological perspective, he would just, you know, spend the rest of the segment dealing with it. And I thought, you just can't run a talk show that way. But let's be honest. First of all, and it's a good example just when we talk about the persecution. Dr. Erwin Lutzer wrote a book about, you know, is God on America's side or is America on God's side? And he went and looked at all of the different aspects of judgment in the Old Testament. Now, we recognize that whether we look at blessings or cursings, whether you look at Genesis 12 or whether you look at Deuteronomy 28, whether you look at 2 Chronicles, a lot of these were specific commands or pronouncements for the nation of Israel, oftentimes in the Old Testament theocracy. But do the principles apply? I think most people would agree with that. You've got two dangers. You have some that see that there is virtually no difference between the United States of America and Israel. That's a real danger. I think the Puritans may have dropped into some of that a little bit. Then there's the other danger of what you referred to. Some people said, okay, what's replacement theology? That is that now the church is Israel. And I would disagree with that as well. Those are kind of the two extremes. But I think either of them are wrong, because on the one hand, I still believe that there's a place for the nation of Israel. And for those of us that have any doubt about that, look at the book of Revelation. You know, in the first three chapters, yeah, they're talking about the church. But after that, it's about as from Revelation 4 on, it's pretty Jewish. So I think there's still a place for the nation of Israel, for Israel per se. And I do not believe that the church has replaced it. So I can obviously disagree with that. And you might remember a couple of weeks before, I had Dr. Mark Bailey, who is the president of Dallas Theological Seminary, actually interacting with somebody on that very question. So I sort of felt like we'd already covered it a little bit. But it's a good point. But I would avoid either one of those two extremes. The Bible does not say that America is Israel, obviously. But also, I don't think the Bible teaches that the church is Israel. And if you can kind of wave your way between those two minefields, I think your theology is pretty good. My Presbyterian friends would hate what I just said, but that's okay. As Christians, how do we keep in perspective without being overcome with fear? Good question. And I've said before that it is a little bit overwhelming sometimes when you listen to the program every day. And people say, how is it that you are so upbeat? You know, I'm a pretty positive guy. Most of you shook my hand tonight, and if I didn't, I want to make sure I shake your hand. And you're probably saying, you're a pretty upbeat guy for all the stuff you deal with all the time. And I do deal with a lot more than even what I tell you on the air. And, you know, I don't make a big deal about all the problems I have, and I don't talk about death threats or anything like that. And you say, how can you be so positive? Well, you've heard the old line, I've read the last book, and I know we win. But more importantly, I recognize how important it is for spiritual disciplines. You know, if I looked horizontally, I get really depressed. But if I look vertically, I'm blessed. And so I really want to pass that on to you. You know, and if really I'm just overwhelming you on point of view, well, turn off the radio for just a minute, but then go back to good news. I don't want you to, you know, miss all the other great stuff. But, I mean, the bottom line is that we are in a time of great challenge. But even this week, if you listen to the program, we talked about the plight of persecuted Christians. It's really hard for me to feel too down in the dumps about what we're dealing with. We still have a chance to make a difference in this culture. And whether we're just the remnant in a culture that just goes off the cliff, or whether we are the people that are going to be the very foundation of the next revival, I don't know. But I just know that we're supposed to be called to be faithful. And one more thing, you know, I mentioned the first great awakening, the second great awakening. Some people have said we sort of had a third great awakening, which was the layman's prayer revival, which happened just before the Civil War. I don't call it that, but some people do. But there's one thing that was true about each one of those revivals. It was really dark before the light shone. And especially the layman's prayer revival, we have almost no understanding of who started that. It was just this prayer meeting that started in Fulton Street in New York. And all of a sudden, everybody just began to be on their knees and began to pray. And then you had all sorts of people that began to take this to other parts of the country. There are stories that are told. One story that was told of this man who was actually guiding the ships into the dock in New York, because even as this day, sometimes you have to have a pilot to bring the ships in so that because they know where to go. And he was a Christian, and he's on the boat, and he's telling these people from Europe about this prayer revival, and they're asking more and more questions. By the time the ship docked, all the people in the boat had become Christians. There's a story that is told of this man who came down the Hudson River from Albany, New York, and he was in the shop, and he was buying all sorts of goods, and they wanted to get back on the ship to go back up to Albany that night, and it was noon. And the shopkeeper said, at noon, we all go to pray. And this man said, well, I need to get all my goods and everything. He said, nope, we're going to go pray. You want to come? And might as well. I didn't have anything else to do for the next hour. So he goes and prays, and he became a Christian. He comes back and then begins to evangelize Albany, which I think needs it right now, but that's another story. And so I just think, you know, you've got to recognize that sometimes it's been really dark before God's Spirit moves and a revival or a reformation breaks out. So it's pretty dark. I'm ready for some light. How about you? Any other ones, real quickly? While I'm looking for one more, I think we're kind of winding down here. Let me see. The younger generations are being educated by a godless system and indoctrinated with lies. How can we combat this stronghold in their lives? And it seems to me that, first of all, you've got to evaluate where your children and grandchildren are, okay, starting first with you. I know there are parents that sometimes say, well, yeah, but if I send my Christian kids into the public schools, they'll be like missionaries. Doesn't that strike you as just a little bit of a mismatch? I mean, you may have some really good schools here, but I can tell you there are a lot of public schools here where I would not send my kids, and yet I'm a product of the public schools. You know, you can become a Christian in Berkeley, California. I became a Christian in Berkeley, California. You can find the Lord in Berkeley, California. Actually, the Lord can find you. But the bottom line is I think you have to first make really good decisions, and I think that's year by year, child by child, what you need to do. Now, does that mean then that we abandon the public schools? I say no. I mean, you are paying your tax dollars. I think you should still think about being on the PTA, think about running for school board, expressing your concerns. But I do believe that we are moving more and more into a system in which, whereas before America was like this, it was kind of this middle class, it started doing more and more of this. And that is, on the one hand, you've got kids that are growing up in Christian homes, intact homes, getting good education. Maybe they're going to the public schools, but their parents are really educating them as well at home. Or they're going to Christian schools or home schools, and they're functionally illiterate. functionally literate, I should say, biblically literate, and they have leadership skills, and they might be the leaders that bring about a reformation in this next generation. But the sad reality is these kids over here. I mean, these kids are functionally illiterate. They're certainly biblically illiterate and oftentimes come from broken homes and have lots of dysfunction. And I wish I could solve all the problems here, but I need at least to emphasize here. Now, those of us that are working on this area trying to bring some of them over here, you've probably heard me say a few times that we have established a school in West Dallas. West Dallas looks even worse than downtown Augusta or Atlanta. I mean, I'm telling you, you have never seen like that. But we have established a school there which has Christian education. It's basically classical Christian education, and we're taking kids out of what is essentially the ghetto and educating them to be teachers to really replicate that in the community. So maybe we can do some of that, but the bottom line is that we certainly need to emphasize the kind of education that takes place there and then empower these students to go out and reach the others. But that's another reason why I'm pretty positive about the future, because who are going to be the leaders in the future? I think a lot of them are going to come from intact homes. They're going to come from strong families. They're going to come from Christian families. Yes, we've had a few presidents that came from broken homes, Bill Clinton, Barack Obama. But most of our leaders in industry, most of our leaders in government come from the kind of homes that you probably represent. Who are going to be the leaders in the 21st century? A lot of them are these little kids here, right here in the room. And I'm encouraged about that as well. One last question. See if somebody wants to, okay. If you shout loud enough, we probably can hear it. How's that?
The question that I have is back to something that you stated about conservatives and liberals at your birth rate. And just recently, I was reviewing something over there, and there's another party that's being introduced that I feel is more dangerous that was not mentioned today at all concerning leadership.
Very good. Good quick. Yeah. And that's something I address in a moment. Yeah.
All of this accumulation here, I know some perhaps will follow the thought of a rapture, but are we close to this world falling apart?
Yeah, good question. And again, if you didn't hear, we recognize that, especially if you go to Europe, that's where I think those numbers work even more significantly, that the birth rate, take France, Germany, and the Netherlands, so those are three very good examples, in which you have a disproportionately high fertility rate among Muslim immigrants, in many cases from Africa, but not exclusively, and also some from the Middle East, compared to those. And in those countries, I think you have to agree with Mark Stein. He wrote a book years ago called America Alone. And his argument was that America is going to be alone because Europe is no longer going to be the Europe that we remember it to be. Let's take your statistics, for example. The birth rate overall in, like, Greece, 1.1, Spain, 1.1, France, 1.7, but that's deceptive because if you look at the birth rate of those people who would be typical French people who are producing boys by the name of Francois or Jacques, it's about 1.1. Well, how do you get up to 1.7? As you point out, it's the Muslim immigrants who are producing, and I think the last number I saw was about 7.1 per family, partially because of polygamy, partially just because they have a higher birth rate. Well, it doesn't even take one generation to figure out what's going to happen, and you're going to have Europe become more and more Muslim. Paris may still exist, but it's not going to look like Paris right now, or even Paris in the past. And when you sometimes hear these stories about French youth rebelling, well, they're Muslim youth, you know, that have names like Muhammad or Abba. Allah or something like that. I mean, it just is. And so that is the case. Now, you're concerned about America. Well, here's the difference. In the Netherlands, the Muslim population is much larger. It's in the 20 to 30% range. In France, maybe 10 to 15%, but still very dominant, and they create these Muslim enclaves, which then make it very difficult for the country to be unified. Another example is in the UK. Right now, it is possible in the civil justice system to have Sharia law. They don't have it in the criminal justice system, but they do have it in the civil justice system. So if there's a question about inheritance or property rights and things like that, the Muslim court rules instead of English common law. Now, people say, well, won't that happen in America? Yeah, but it's going to take a lot longer. How many Muslims in America? Hard to say. Maybe 3 million. Some people, CARE says 7 million. I don't believe that for a minute. But yes, you do have some Muslims here. How many Americans we have? Over 300 million. So the ratios aren't significant enough unless we decide unilaterally to begin to implement Sharia law. And that's why you're seeing a backlash. If you go to Oklahoma, for example, in the last election, they passed a piece of legislation through their initiative and referendum to actually say that you cannot use Sharia law to interpret the various legal documents. So I do believe that it is a threat, and I think the Muslim threat in Europe is in their face, and it is right now. For us, it's something that we can learn about. Yeah, it certainly could. Yeah, now back to your other question about prophecy. I've got to make at least one prophetic statement before we're done, and that is a lot of people are starting to say that maybe the people that have been speaking on prophecy haven't emphasized enough the influence of Islam. If you look at the book of Revelation, how were most people killed? They're beheaded. Now, of course, we've had beheadings before Islam, but, you know, you've got to wonder about that. Now, you either got to come up with a scenario that Islam gets minimized because the Battle of Gog and Magog, Ezekiel 38 and 39, happens at some point, and then the Muslim army is decimated. Or you've got to say Muslims are still around. Second largest religion in the world. In some areas of the world, the fastest growing religion in the world. And so I think we have to recognize how important it is for us to understand what Islam is all about. And one of the books back there is my biblical point of view on Islam, just to help you understand what is the real threat. And if you think about it today, what's the greatest challenge for missions around the world? Used to be basically communism. I mean, I know that it's still a challenge in North Korea and Albania, and I'm not minimizing a billion people in China, although there's a lot of freedom that we have even in that country. But it used to be that you couldn't even get the gospel behind the Iron Curtain. I go quite frequently to Hungary, in Budapest, Hungary. Word of Life has a training center there. And the training center is actually in a castle that was used by the communists to indoctrinate students in communism. Now that same castle is used by Word of Life to teach students the Bible and systematic theology, which I think shows God has a sense of humor, nothing else. But no. And so, you know, some of those closed countries now aren't so closed. Some of those communist countries are pretty open. Did you see Russia the other day? They passed a law saying that they want to teach religion in the schools. If that was put forward here, the ACLU, the People United for Separation of Church and State, and the Religious Freedom from Religion Foundation would probably have a coronary, and that's what they're doing there. So those countries aren't as closed. It's still difficult to do ministry in the former Soviet Union and those Soviet bloc countries, but not like it was. What are the closed countries today? The Muslim countries. And that's going to be the greatest challenge. So I think, first of all, we need to know our doctrine. You know, first of all, I would have to say the greatest doctrine under attack in the 21st century would be the doctrine of the Trinity. Why? Because Muslims deny the Trinity. By the way, have you ever had anybody knock at your door and say they're with the Watchtower Society? Did Jehovah's Witnesses deny the Trinity? Okay, one of the most aggressive evangelistic groups. How about another one? You ever seen two boys in white shirts with bicycles that, you know, do they deny the Trinity in a different sort of way? Make my case. You know, those are doctrines we're going to need to know. And we need to educate one another. But most importantly, on this country, I still think there are a lot of Muslim students who are open to the gospel. You heard me this week share the number of Muslims that are coming to know the Lord, and that's good. And even in my own church, you know, there was a Muslim couple. They drove by this, and they weren't even sure we were a church. But finally, they came in one Sunday, and they just sat there. Jack Graham preached the gospel. They came forward, accepted Christ. The next week, they were baptized. Muslims want to know that they can be saved. And they really live in this world where they really don't know that. In my book, I talk about the fact that they've done surveys, and they found, first of all, of 700 former Muslims who have converted to Christianity, interestingly enough, the number one reason in all these surveys that was done in a seminary that these 700 former Muslims converted to Christianity, the love of God. Because a Muslim doesn't know God. God is, you know, Allah is transcendent. He's unknowable. He's capricious. He's unpredictable. But they wanted to know God. The second reason was eternal security, that they could know. Because a Muslim just hopes that my good works will outweigh my bad works, and I'll eventually find my way into paradise. So we've got the gospel. Let's take the